Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Well, now, would you look at this? It's another bright, sparkly, spangly, festive, timelessly edition of Books of the Year. Well, I mean, as we speak, it's 1 o'clock on Tuesday, the 11th of December.
But let's not strip away the magic, because I'm sure people are probably listening to this just before Christmas. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, or they could be listening. They might just discover us in March 2019.
That's true. In which case, please tell us everything's better now. Is it? Please.
You sound as though you don't expect things to be any better.
Is it some apocalyptic wasteland?
But things can only get better.
Yeah, well, they can't get much worse.
Well, they actually can get a whole lot worse. When you think about it. In fact, by the time people have heard this, they might have already got a whole lot worse.
Stockpiling medicine, and we're not even at war.
And they might be fighting in the streets and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And Roger Daltrey thinks, our guest today, thinks that The Who is music to fight to.
Yes, no. Reading his book, there is so, well, we'll get into this in the interview itself, but there's so much primal, fighty stuff within their music that I hadn't thought of before.
I'm quite a fighter.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I'm more of a lover.
Is that right? So Roger Daltrey is on the way. Josie Moynihan, I enjoyed listening to you two and John Simpson talking about Moscow, Midnight. I was surprised and delighted by John's mischievous indiscreetness.
Mm.
Keep up the good work. Take care. And actually, Phil Williams at Five Live, our old colleague, said he laughed out loud. He sort of spurted his coffee,
yeah,
I think, when we mentioned the Mark Mardell moment.
Yes, having listened to that back, I wonder whether John realized how indiscreet he was going to be until the point where he was really indiscreet. It just felt like that with me. Rachel, regular emailer to the show, says, to be absolutely honest, I was expecting a very dry interview with John Simpson.
Thanks a lot.
However, it was anything but. John is refreshingly direct in expressing his views and opinions. It was rather touching when he talked about being sidelined by the BBC. I'm glad he had a reprieve. I really enjoyed the pod. Actually, I think it's now one of my top favourites, with interesting talk about the book and jolly good stories too. Looking forward to the Q&A.
This is from Griffin Hanson. Actually, shall I carry on reading Griffin Hanson?
I don't think
even
you should,
Roger Daltrey is about to walk in.
He's literally about to come in. So,
do we stand when Roger comes in?
Yes, I'm assuming that's the case.
No,
okay. Here we go.
So it's Simon and Matt. And here's Roger.
Hello, Roger. Nice to see you again. How are you?
Hey, Roger.
This is Matt.
Hi.
I'd love a cappuccino, please.
Yep.
How's life for you, mate?
It's all right, Roger. Thank you very much. Yes, good. It's okay. And pretty non-stop with your book.
Well, I'm a bit of a crossroads. You know, I'm 75 next year, and that's...
Looking pretty good, I have to say.
Not bad for 75, no.
I'm fit, but it's still a crossroads in the head, you know. You feel the end racing up. Because Christmas seems to be every other weekend these days. It comes around so quick.
I can't believe you're 75, because you're looking about 54.
Yeah.
If you don't mind me saying. And do you feel kind of intimations of mortality, you know, do you think?
Yeah, of course. I mean, the last 4 years of my life have been pretty traumatic. Mm. When I got that dose of meningitis, that was a wake-up call. Because I did my biography rather different than most people do theirs. I didn't have a book deal. I didn't want one, because I kind of didn't know whether I had a good biography in me. And if I had taken the money on a book deal, I would have had to come up with something. And all I wanted was a good book. So I employed someone to work with me to kind of keep a kind of editorial eye on it. And been working on it for 3 years, and I got this dose of meningitis, which I really did think was going to take me. And when I came out of it, I kind of thought, well, I better get this book finished because there's not much left.
So I suppose maybe you need that kind of shock to the system to make you think, okay, well, if I'm not going to get this down, I don't want to rely on someone else looking at all.
Well, that was it. That was really it. I just wanted to, because I wanted to try and, in this book, I found so many of the rock and roll biographies, like when they start talking about music, for instance, for me, was like, it's like listening to a portrait gallery. It's boring for me, you know. So I wanted to try and give the reader an idea of what it felt like to do, you know, what I've done through my life, and what, you know, what were the emotional traumas of the time, or, you know, how did you deal with situations personally? It's just my view of it, and, you know, and I'm sure if Pete wrote a book from his personal point of view of how it was, it would be completely different.
And I mean, we'll discuss the different bits and pieces and the stories and the professional side and the personal side as well. But did you enjoy actually trying to put it all down in one book, you know, all of your story, the rock and roll and the relationships and how you all met and the stuff that went well, the stuff that went badly? Was that, and did you enjoy that whole process?
Well, you know, the way I did it, I just employed a journalist friend of mine to do loads of interviews. And I answered all the questions very honestly. And then we just, because the only way you can do a good biography is to be very honest about yourself and about your life. And that's how I did it. And like I say, he kept the editorial eye on it to keep it in a shape that would make a book form. Yeah. And then I wrote, you know, because when you speak, it's not written language. Spoken language is very different from written language. So I kind of had to write over it, which was kind of a weird experience. Mm. And then doing the, I found the most difficult thing of all was doing the audio book. That was really weird. That was painful.
Why?
Well, it was like living, that really was like living like my life again. And because there's a lot of trauma in there. I mean, I lost a lot of friends and those moments, especially when you're doing the audio book, you just can't do a flat read, make a nonsense of it. So you have to kind of live it again to put yourself back in the brain space you were at the time when those things were happening. And some of those things were very painful.
Did you check any of it with Pete Townsend or with your wife?
No, it's my bloody book.
Check any of it with Heather?
No. Huh?
Did you check any of it with your wife?
Oh, she's read. Yeah, of course I gave it. Of course I let her read it because I, you know, our relationship, you know, to air your personal life in public is not easy. And she had to be okay with how it was. But, you know, like she said, it's how it's been.
Yeah. Can I just start? I mean, there are so many things to talk to you about. You choose to start. I mean, you mentioned your health, but you start with an incident in 2007 and a gig where it goes wrong for you personally.
It all goes pear-shaped.
It all goes pear-shaped. And it ends up with someone in a hospital saying, when was the last time you broke your back, Mr. Daughtry?
When did you break your back, Mr.
Daughtry?
I mean, and like out of the blue, there's this doctor saying, when did you break your back? And I said, well, I haven't. And then he said, well, I'm sorry, but I beg to differ. And he showed me the x-ray. And there it was, one broken back. And this one not very careful owner. But so then I had to think, you know, back when could I have done it? And then I started to think it could have been then, it could have been then, it could have been at least four times that I'd had really serious, quite serious accidents. Yeah, and this whole body's been beaten about a bit, I'll tell you.
Yeah. And it's one of the many moments in the book where you think your life could have gone in a very different direction if things had just turned out slightly differently for you.
My life could have gone very, very differently, yeah, definitely. I mean, the age of 19, I got married because I got a girl pregnant, and that's what you did in those days. And I tried to make that marriage work, and I was living in one room of a council flat in Wandsworth with a mother-in-law in this council flat, and it was hard. And I tried and I tried and I stuck it for about... until my son arrived, and I had about 3 months of that, but I couldn't do it. And I kind of used to look out of the window six stories up in this block of flats, and the group van would be in the street. And the name of the group in those days was the Detours. So on the side of the van was painted the Detours with an arrow at the end of it. So the arrow was kind of pointing towards the front, so the van was going in the direction of the arrow. And I swear that that van was calling me. You know, that if I could make the dream work, I could do better for everybody. And I had to take the chance, and I walked out on my family. I still supported them, and I went on supporting them. And as we did well, I went back and supported them even more, you know, and we became very close, because my first wife married again, had two, had another two kids, and became very close with myself and my new wife and my two kids at the time. So that, it all worked out in the end, but it was that crunch moment when you just think, I've got to try to get something better than this, because I can't go on doing this.
And you don't regret that, do you?
I can't regret it, no. No, not at all.
Because if you, I mean...
If I hadn't have done it, I would probably be, who knows where I would have gone. I don't know whether I could have stood that life in that one room very much longer now.
It occurs to me, we haven't even mentioned the title of the book. Thanks a lot, Mr. Kibble-White. Anyway, Roger's coffee has just arrived, so while Roger is having some of his cappuccino, we can explain the title later, although you've explained it many times. But anyway, we can mention that when we get to school. Matt?
Yeah, I want to talk to you about something you've actually just mentioned now, which is about the difference between different music biographies, autobiographies that you've read. And I would argue that those kind of books fit into pretty much the same kind of genre as sport autobiographies, in that you'll have certain sport books which are analysing in great detail every goal that particular player has scored, which is mind-numbingly dull. You have other biographies, which is, I'm going to tell you the gossip inside the dressing room, which is diverting, but that's all it is. The better ones are the ones that bring you a degree of insight. And this is what I got from your book, particularly about singing. And there's a word you use to describe your singing, which is primal. And even though, you know, I've listened to you sing, and many of the people listening to this podcast will have heard you sing, primal absolutely describes how they would put Roger Daltrey singing. But it still jumped out at me, because I think the episode you talk about, which isn't what you were expecting, is you at work with, this is before The Who have taken off, this is you working in a, I think it's sheet metal...
sheet metal work factory,
exactly. Yeah. And all the other guys would be singing. There'd be no radio on. Nobody was singing along to something. They were just singing. And that is primal.
That was the joy of growing up in the period we grew up in. Post-war London. Singing was everywhere. Every building site you go by, all the builders would be singing. Every garage you go by, everyone would be singing. The milkman sang, the postman sang. Everyone sang. The pubs at the weekend would be, there would always be a piano going or something, and people would be singing. People, it got them through the war. One thing Hitler could never understand about the British, the more he bombed them, the louder they sang. So it was, I don't know, and there's something wonderful about when people sing together. I love the noise of a football crowd when you're in the stadium and they start singing. That is pure primal humanity. It's wonderful. And the science on it is that when people sing together, their heartbeats go to the same rhythm. And that's scientifically proven. I find that incredible. That is, it's so socially cohesive. And we don't do enough of it these days. Where has it gone? Where has it gone? Wake up in the morning, open your gob and sing, for Christ's sake.
There are great traditions in some pubs in the north of England where you go to the pub and sing carols. You can do it in church, but a lot of people just do it in the pub. Yeah. And someone comes around and they start singing, and the whole pub is singing carols. And that sort of isn't happening anymore either.
No, but it's, I think that's
tragic. That's a great tradition, isn't it? You know, go and get a pint of beer and sing Hark the Herald.
Yeah, It's tragic that people don't sing anymore.
How much singing went on at Acton Grammar for you, Roger?
Not a lot. Not very much at all there. But there, you know, there was a little. You know, I'd made my first guitars, and I was really interested in skiffle. And I was kind of mimicking Lonnie Donegan, as were millions of other kids around the country. And I had this little skiffle group in Shepherd's Bush, and we used to rehearse at the Soulgrave Boys Club on the Goldhawk Road. But the grammar school music class wanted to teach me with dots on pages, and I, you know, it didn't mean anything to me. I wanted music to make a noise. I wanted I wanted to either play an instrument or I wanted to hear it. I don't want to read it.
Lonnie Donegan actually has come up before. A few episodes of this podcast ago, we had on one show, we had Mark Kermode, film critic, and Alan Johnson, former Labour Home Secretary. And the one thing that they had, they were like music memoirs. And the one thing that they talked about, the one thing they had in common was Lonnie Donegan and the power of Lonnie Donegan. Can you just explain what it was about? Because you mentioned Elvis on the same page, but it's actually Lonnie Donegan that kind of brings it home to you. Can you explain?
Well, Elvis was style, and he was kind of almost like watching someone who'd come in from outer space. It was like, he was so different, and But Lonnie, when we saw Lonnie on the TV, that was, again, it was the way Lonnie sang. Elvis was kind of, it was a veneer. It was on, it felt like, you know, what he was, the where the voice was coming from, it was all very good, but it was very considered, and a veneer on, that he'd adopted, like an act. But with Lonnie, again, it was primal. He used to throw his head back and wail. And you go, whoa! And it moved you in a different way. I mean, there was just something about him. And he was completely square. I mean, he used to come on in a dinner jacket and a bow tie, which was completely untrendy. You know, when Elvis was in his, you know, zoot suits and, you know, tight trousers, drainpipe trousers, well, what were considered drainpipe trousers, but they were kind of zoot suit trousers, which were baggy at the tops and tight at the bottom. But Lonnie, it was just the way he sang. It just moved you in a different way than Elvis, because this came from the inside. This wasn't a veneer on the outside.
Did you have, when you were putting the band together, I think it's the summer of 61, you talk about connected with John Entwistle, then you audition the kid with the impressive sneezer. and then Keith Moon is. But did you have skiffle in? Did you have Lonnie Donegan in common? Is that what you were trying to?
No, both John and Pete were in a jazz band. I mean, Pete was had a musical background from his father and his mother. His mother was a singer. His grandfather, you know, his whole family were musicians to way back the Townsends. Quite very interesting. You know, history there. They were in a trad band, and Pete played banjo, John played trumpet. But then John was also interested in the bass. And I just bumped into John on the street, and like me, he'd made his own bass. And it was an extraordinary looking instrument. It really was. It looked nothing like any other bass guitar you'd ever seen. It had the longest neck. which he kept, that kind of style of bass, he kept right until the end. You know, I've got one of his, what was it called? I can't remember the name of it, but one of his basses. And then I can just about reach the end of the neck. It's so long. And he just used to love these long neck basses. And he had huge fingers, John, beautiful hands. And he was a magical bass player.
And you mentioned, I guess it's an audition for Keith Moon, and I think you're playing Roadrunner by Bo Diddley. And can you just explain what that moment was like when Keith comes in and he's doing this audition and it kind of takes off, really?
We were a Stones alike band at the time. We were doing blues, but we were three piece. Unlike the Stones, we didn't have a rhythm guitarist. We had just Pete doing kind of Mick Green, Wilco Johnson type lead and solo at the same time. So that, and between John's very intricate bass playing, John never ever played straight bass. It was almost like John played bass like a lead guitarist. Pete played rhythm like a drummer. So it was kind of very weird syncopation always with The Who. And I was a singer, and we had a session drummer playing. And Keith got up and said, "I can play better than that guy. Can I have a go?" And the drummer let him use his kit. And Keith got up and started playing. And we played Roadrunner, Bo Diddley's Roadrunner. And it just started off the usual down, 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 down. But then halfway through, Moon started going to double in the beat. And for some reason or the other, what I have to explain to you now, a lot of people don't really understand, is that the singer in a three-piece band very rarely sees the band, but you feel them. So it's all about the feel that's coming from behind you for the singer. And I immediately felt this, like someone had put the key in the ignition, and this energy came through the music. And it just took off. It was extraordinary that Keith added to it. And it just linked the whole algorithm of these, like I say, this lead guitar bass player, this drumming rhythm lead guitarist, and a drummer that played like no other drummer we'd ever heard. It was extraordinary.
The energy you've just spoken about, that leads me on to something I want to talk about. You talked about how you could feel that energy as the singer, so you can feel it coming from behind you. I want to talk about the experience that the crowd would have had, because my instinct from reading your book is that going to see The Who at that time would be a bit like sailing a yacht right next to a waterfall. It's going to be exhilarating, it's going to be great fun, but at any point, it could tip over and that anything could happen. And so that, again, comes down to this sort of primal nature of the band at this time. That much energy, that much primal fear coming out of the band means that at any point, things could snap.
Yeah, there was. We were very dangerous. I mean, we were dangerous. I suppose all bands have it, but we all had enormous egos. We were also. I had to rule them with a kind of bit of an iron fist at the time, because they were all getting. They were quietly becoming three addicts. So it took a lot to keep them in shape, and you know, I was the guy who drove the van, got all the stuff together, booked the you know, made sure we got to gigs, all that stuff, responsible stuff. So I kind of became dad, you know, in a way to the rest of them, but it created a very dangerous friction around us, and I did used to rule it with an iron fist, and I was kind of inarticulate, yob from the street, and I used to solve things with my fists, you know. But dealing with Pete, who was could be very articulately cutting, Keith could be the same. He had a vocabulary way beyond his education. I don't know where he got it from. Extraordinary. And he could be the same. John was just quiet, but he was quietly, you know, he had a kind of wicked side to him. John was an only child, and his mum got divorced and married another guy. John literally hated his stepdad. I think that had an effect on John, which gave him this kind of spiteful side.
So you put all four of those.
Yeah, so at any moment. It was the band that everyone thought, if they last to the end of the week, they'll be doing well.
Wow.
And after every record, you know, well, this will probably be the last one, and then this will be the last one. But for some reason or the other, we hung together, you know, longer than most, just like the Stones.
And is all of that the reason why you've described The Who as music to fight to?
Well, yeah. I mean, but because, you know, at one point, some genius of a record company came up with the idea, it was the greatest rock and roll band in the world, The Who. We never were a rock and roll band. We've never been a rock and roll band since the day Keith Moon joined us. The day Keith Moon joined us, rock and roll is, you know, Chuck Berry, pub music, dance music, music to make love to, you know. This, the in and out, it's just ever so simple. Who music is on the one. It's like... it's fun, you know, it's in your face. That's the only way I can describe it. And it you can play the same rhythm, it's the same tempo, but it's where the slap is, isn't it? And instead of it becomes...
You're testing the percussion qualities of our table, you know, now.
Then that goes... I don't know how he did it. I mean, Moon's rhythms were, like, extraordinary. So he, you know, they got that completely wrong. We never, ever were a rock band, a rock and roll band. We were always a rock band.
I think you got that message through. I think they did.
Hope so.
So there's
I'll build the table back.
There might be a couple of cracks in there somewhere. There's clearly a moment which changed you as a singer, and I guess sort of affected the fortunes of the band a lot, and that's when Tommy comes out, which is still strikes me as the most amazing idea for a concept album.
It's wonderful.
Ever. When you were told the idea, can you remember what you...
Well, the idea initially was so simple. That's what was always great about something that Pete, with all his complicated and intellectual thinking, would always come up with one line I would... could fire me up. And the line that came out, he says, just imagine going through life, just experiencing life through vibration, which is what music is, you know. And I just thought that was genius. So then they put it into this Deaf, Dumb and Blind Boys, and slowly but surely this thing built up into becoming what it ended up being. But I think Tommy's one of the best operas ever written. It's certainly got the most lyrics. Because I've been going to quite a few grand operas recently, and that's the one thing they're pretty short of is the lyrics.
And most of them are in Italian or German or something like that.
But equally, they sing the same line. You can repeat. You think, oh, yeah, and what else? But Tommy, I don't know, there's something magical about it. And I've always seen the cousin Kevin and Uncle Ernie characters as being kind of one character. They're all sides of... We've all got the potential to be those... to be kind of that nasty side of the balance, you know, the balanced person. And we did it at the time all very tongue-in-cheek because there was always, you know... I remember the holiday camp idea, which was Keith's, and it was based on a very bad kind of, you know... based on a bloody concentration camp, right, basically. Black, that very dark post-war humour. You know, we're going to go to this holiday camp, we're never going to come out, you know. It was horrible. It wasn't fun, you know, but that was our humour at the time. It was very dark humour.
Can you explain... Well,
that's kind of embarrassing in a way now.
And can you explain... Because you said that everything you learnt to do with your voice came from Tommy. Can you just see how it affected you as a singer? And why it was...
The period from my generation through to Tommy was very difficult because Pete threw some really weird songs at me. I was a blues singer and I could deal with my generation, I could deal with anyhow, anywhere, could deal with Can't Explain. But then I got kind of I'm a Boy thrown at me and I was like, whoa, what's this about? And it was about... A mother who wanted, she was going to have quads and she wanted four girls, but she'd had three girls and a boy. But she was treating the boy as a girl. And, of course, the boy is going, but I'm a boy. My mom won't admit it. So all of a sudden I was presented with this song and I'm thinking, how am I going to sing this? And I struggled and I struggled and I struggled, and I ended up with what the record is. And it's only now when I listen to it, I think I got it perfectly right, because that voice has got a haunted quality in it. And it is the boy struggling to be recognised as a boy, you know, amongst three girls in a family. It's kind of, it's a weird voice. It's not anything like my voice once I got to Tommy. Once I got to Tommy, I'm playing this character that goes all the way through it. And there's so many emotions in there, it gave me scope to explore. The record is one thing. Once we got it on the stage, it became another completely different bag of, you know, chips. I mean, it was like really weird. I just grew and grew and grew as a singer. And I also developed a stage persona that suited. I kind of built a Tommy, an image for the thing, you know.
I want to talk to you, Roger, about The Who on tour, because I know me as a teenage boy, and I'm going to say I wouldn't have been alone in this, but if you'd said to me, pick out any career you want, and I would have said rock star in a rock band that's doing very well on tour in the United States and we're selling out everywhere. Reading your book, that is the lifestyle you're in. And it sounds like a complete nightmare, because you are being chucked out of hotels at 3 a.m, which, you know, because Keith Moon has set off cherry bombs in the toilet, and that's amusing story to tell when you get home. But at 3 a.m, you're being chucked out of a hotel, and it also gets old very quickly when that's the fourth night on the trot that you've been chucked out of the hotel. I think if this book does anything, it sort of strips away that glamour of a rock star lifestyle and this is at the top of your game as well.
Well, like I say, when people, you know, kind of wish for fame, it's an awful lot of hard work involved, and an awful lot of hard work. And I always say, be careful what you wish for, because unless you're prepared to put that work in, the fame on its own will just kill you. And as it did, you know, quite a few people. But living with Keith Moon, it was incredibly volatile. You just never knew from one day to the next whether you'd find him alive in the morning. Towards the end, the last 4 years of his life, it was almost like, that's why he's, you know, it was almost like, you know, how are we going to get through this week? How are we going to get through the next week? And, you know, literally on tenterhooks. But that made his death even more of a shock for some reason, because after 4 years of expecting it, it was like, shit, it's actually happened. Was shocking.
But you do talk in the book about how you'd noticed that his talents were diminishing because of that.
He noticed. I mean, that was a really sad day, because my relationship with Keith was very, very different than anybody else in the band, because at the beginning, I was Keith's enemy, because I used to stand in front of him. And Keith always used to feel that the drummer should be on the front of the stage. He based his style on Gene Krupa. And if you watch Gene Krupa, the way he drums with the drumsticks down, and Gene Krupa used to be at the front of the stage. Well, that's where Keith wanted to be. But, of course, fuck you, you're going to go back there, you know. So I was the enemy. So for all that, for the first sort of 2-3 years till the summer of 1967, when we went on our first American tour, Keith and I used to be, there was quite a lot of friction between us. But at the end of his life, I was the closest one to him. And that made his death really, I took it very badly, very, very badly, because we were desperately trying to help him. And Heather and I were the last people. He'd kind of worn everybody else out, because he used to ring up at 4 a.m. in a terrible state. He used to feel useless when he was sober. He said, I'm nobody when I'm sober. Nobody likes me when I'm sober. And he just couldn't do it. And then he used to ring up and crying and 4 o'clock in the morning. And Heather was really, my wife Heather was fantastic with him. She would always talk to him for half an hour at 4 in the morning, you know, when everybody else was putting the phone down. I would talk to him. But that, I took it very bad, because I thought I could, I thought I could change him, and I couldn't.
We spoke to Michael Parkinson. He was in here talking about George Best, which is his latest book, and he said it took a while for him and people around George to realise that he didn't want to be helped. Actually, did Keith want to be helped?
Or? Yeah, he did. He did. That was the tragedy of it. The drug that killed him was an anti-alcoholic drug. You know, it was to stop the drinking. But I'm going to make a film of Keith next year. I'm working on it now. I've been trying for 30 years, but I can't get the right script. But I've got a writer now that I think has the potential to come up with it. Jeff Pope. Look him up. And we'll see, because I have got an idea of a film about Keith that will. But it has to be a film. It can't be a biopic. If that makes sense to you.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I don't like biopics. The only good biopic I've seen, I think, was possibly the Beach Boy one a while ago, with two Brian Wilsons.
So this is going to be a proper cinematic
a film
experience.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's certainly an operatic life.
Well, you know, he was such an extraordinary character. And like I say, there was a journey. And if I capture that journey and what Keith was going through at the time, it would be a very interesting film. But like I say, his drumming did deteriorate quite badly at the end. And unfortunately for Keith, that he saw it in glorious technicolour in The Kids Are All Right, because, you know, the last bits of film we shot for that, I Won't Get Fooled Again, I think it was, or Barbara O'Reilly, I can't remember what song it was, he knows that he was being held on a drum kit by a roadie at the back of him, just keep him sitting upright, because he was so out of it. Mm. And the drumming was very sloppy. And he, you know, for him, watching that film, The Kids Are All Right, must have been like falling off a cliff and watching his whole life go before him. And he's gone from this beautiful, young, adorable kind of Davy Jones kind of drummer. He looked, you know, he was the girl's favourite in the band, to being this bloated, overweight, podgy, useless drummer being held on a drum kit by a roadie. It must have been incredibly painful. He came out from the first screening of that. He was there with his girlfriend. I was there with Heather. And he was crying. And that's when we were going to build a gym. We were going to get fit. We were getting fit. And I promised him if he got fit, I'd get Pete back on the road touring. He did try. He signed up for riding lessons at Rotten Row. That was his idea of getting fit.
Going for riding lessons.
You just had to love him. You just had to love him. He was a character and a half.
Talking to Roger Daltrey, his book is Thanks a Lot, Mr. Kibblewhite, and we'll do more with Roger in just a second. Roger Daltrey is our guest on the podcast. Thanks a Lot, Mr. Kibblewhite is the book. And I was one of the reasons we're excited to have you here, Roger, is I had one of those parenting moments with my eldest. This is a few years back, and he had a stressful exam or test at school. So I'm driving into school, and we've got The Who on a CD, and Won't Get Fooled Again comes out. And I turn it, and I'm explaining the relevance of this song and how it has the greatest scream in the history of rock at the end, and to listen out for it. And, you know, there's this whole sense of expectations. This is the full version of the track, right? And also it has the greatest final line in any rock song ever, which I still think it's an amazing payoff. Anyway, so he's listened to this. He's thinking, this is great. You know, now I've done my job. I've taken his mind off the test. And later that evening, he comes in and his eyes are glowing and he's so excited. And I said, oh, you know, how did it go? And, you know, what did you think about The Who and all that kind of stuff? And He wasn't excited and thrilled because of the story that I told in the track that he listened to, but he just watched The Simpsons. And he said, "Dad, The Who were playing Springfield." and The Who play Springfield, and you play Won't Get Fooled Again. And what I'd said was fine, you know, vaguely interesting, but the fact that, that you played The Simpsons.
That's when you know you've made it, when you've been on The Simpsons. Oh, that was wonderful to do that show.
That was like cross-generational. That was amazing. That was really terrific. Can I ask you about Woodstock? Because people, I mean, certainly I don't remember Woodstock, but you hear the legend and you hear the story. And what you don't hear is The Who turning up in a VW.
It wasn't The Who, it was me, the singer of The Who.
Okay.
I don't know, the others got there in the Hertz station wagon.
Yeah, but I mean, you were supposed to arrive in a helicopter like everyone else.
Well, you know, it just shows you, you know, even then there was such a thing as fake news. Because, you know, I was in Connecticut with my in-laws 2 days before. The thing started on the Friday. We were due to play the Saturday and it was due to finish on the Sunday. But on the Thursday night, Woodstock was headline news on every TV station right across the country. About this 500,000 people had turned up, all these hippies who were running around naked and doing it. And there was enormous rain storms and thunderstorms and, good, you know, terrible weather. So the whole place was a quagmire of mud and crap and everything. The fences had been torn down. It was completely out of control. The governor of New York had declared a state of emergency. All the roads were closed. This was what's coming across the news. So you're sitting there. I was sitting there in Connecticut watching this on a Thursday night. On the Friday, it's still the same news. Woodstock, and there's more film of all this chaos and someone's died. And people were being born. It's like madness. And there's the only way you can get in is by helicopter and all this. I'm thinking, well, how are we going to get there? And my father-in-law says, well, drives there. Well, and all we had was a little Volkswagen, a little red Beetle. So Heather and I got in the back and I had the mother and father-in-law in the front. And we drove to Woodstock, and we every time we came to a roadblock where the traffic was all backed up, he just drove up the emergency lane, and every time we got to a block, he just drove up the bank. We went round it, and people waved us through, and Herbie went to Woodstock. And all this stuff about, and there were no helicopters. I never went in a helicopter at Woodstock. We drove to Woodstock for the show in the Hertz station wagon. Most of that was, I don't know. Like I say, it was fake news then.
It feels like a legend. It feels, I mean, you almost don't go on
but
stage.
The one thing I've always felt about Woodstock is that everybody talks about the bands and they talk about them, but the stars of Woodstock were the crowd. They were incredible. I mean, and you have to, when you look back through history, you've got to say that Woodstock was the event that changed the course of the Vietnam War. That was the one event that made the government sit up and take notice and think, we've got to do something about this and start, you know, the trend to get out of Vietnam. America to get out, because these youngsters were being drafted. I mean, us here in Britain, we've got no idea what young America went through at that time. It was horrible.
That is where the legend came from. I do want to just ask you finally about something you say, which I started by asking you about sport books, and this is something that tallied with that as well, and that is the idea of flow. When sports stars talk about flow, it's when they're competing and they feel like they're floating above themselves, watching themselves play. And the best example of that is all Ayrton Senna driving around Monaco Grand Prix, where he feels like he is floating above the car, watching himself perform because he is so in the moment. And you talk about that being on stage where you feel like this isn't me, I'm watching someone else, and that is when I'm nailing it the most, when I'm in that state of flow. Of how do you attain that sort of that mindset?
I can't explain it to you. It is such a weird feeling. You just, if you try, it you fail. You've got to give. You've just got to let go, and you just got to trust. You've got to listen. You've got to feel, and when it happens, it's just magical. I'm never more of a Roger Daltrey than I am when I'm in that moment. I'm complete. I feel like at last my life makes sense.
You describe it like a state of grace almost, the way
it is. It's this most amazing feeling. It's you know that you can watch football teams when once they start to try and score, like miss after miss after miss after miss after miss, like watching the Arsenal.
Yeah, thank heavens.
But well, not so much now though. We're getting better. But you know, it's like that. It's quite common that you once you stop trying and just let yourself flow with it, let yourself feel it, don't stop the worry. The worry just produces nothing.
Final question, Roger. Obviously, meeting John and Keith and Pete and forming the band, incredibly important as part of this story. But I wonder if meeting Heather, your wife of, is it 50 years?
51. We've lived together for 51 years.
51 years.
We've been married for just 49 years next year.
So that's almost your greatest achievement?
Well, meeting her was the best bit of luck I ever had. And she was my sole partner. True partner, understood me, understood our business more than anything, understood our business. And that's why my marriage has survived, because I was able to be honest with her about what our business was like and what the pitfalls were of it, and the fact that there's no way I would have got through it. And I didn't want to come back and off of a 3 month tour of America as a young man. You've got to remember, I'm very young, 27 years old, and you know, say from the biggest rock band in the world and say, yes darling, I've been a really good boy, I've been lying through my back teeth, you know, just I'm a human being, and I didn't want to ever have to do that. So I said, look, I can't promise I'm going to be one of those guys who's going to, you know, be in a normal kind of marriage with you. But she wanted to have children, so did I, and I adore her. I adore her. And we're true partners. That's the secret. We're true partners.
Roger, it's a privilege to have you on the show, and we appreciate you coming in. And we never even got to explain the title, because this right. is the only interview that
is... It doesn't matter
isn't...
about the title.
It doesn't matter about the title. You'll have to buy the book.
I fought and fought for this title, because everyone wanted to call it, you know, My Generation or the Daltrey. They wanted to have a big picture of my face on the front. And I looked at the biographies on the shelf and I thought, well, they've all got a face on the front with a name. What's the point, you know? And I thought, no, I want to call my book something else. And my headmaster at the grammar school, after giving me six of the best on my bare ass, which I'll tell you, you never forget.
No.
Makes your eyes water. As he was expelling me on my, and I can't remember whether it was the last day of my 14th year or my 15th birthday, it was one of the two. As I was going out of his office, you know, kind of gritted teeth, he said in my ear, "You'll never make anything of your life, Daltrey." And I went, oh. Thanks a lot, Mr. Kilwyde.
There you go. So thanks indeed to Mr. Kilwyde.
But in the fullness of time, it is a true thank you to Mr. Kilwyde, because I have to say he was a teacher, he was a good teacher doing his job. I was a disruptive pupil. If he hadn't have said that to me, who knows where my life would have gone. You know, the fact that he said it, I thought, well, I'll show you.
And you have done. Before you go, Roger, just to mention the Teenage Cancer Trust concert at the Royal Albert Hall, which you've made such an important part of your life, are back again, March the 25th, Rudimental, and then it's Take That, and Doves, and Levelers, and The Script. So this is an important part of your life.
That's a huge part of my life. That's the other job. That really is. Because it's not only Teen the Teenage Cancer Trust. I've started Teen Cancer America because what the Teenage Cancer Trust do over here in our national health system, it's very difficult to explain to the public. When they go into our Teenage Cancer Trust wards, we are in the NHS, but we are not part of it. That ward is built by the charity, all charitable money. We do get some help with the nursing staff that we put in there, specialist nursing staff for these teenagers. But the cost of building these wards and giving adolescents and young adults an environment where they can be amongst their peers against the old system of where they used to be amongst screaming kids with nurseries and rainbows and clowns, I can tell you some horror stories, is proving to be so beneficial to the success of the medicine. It's unbelievable. And I've now started it in America. We've been going 6 years. We've got 21 hospitals, some of the biggest cancer hospitals in the world, already covered, 21. At the end of next year, we should have probably more in America than we have here. Programs. It's a different system over there. We have programs for adolescents and young adults. Australia have accepted it. We lead the world in the care of adolescents and young adults. It's time we woke up. They are not children. They are not adults. They sit in the middle. They need to be amongst their own. To isolate them socially and psychologically when they're in hospital with any hospitalised disease, it is criminal to do it. We are at the point in history now where we need to take this on board and have whole sections of hospitals devoted to that age group, because the damage that's being done by isolating them when they're hospitalised is appalling. It really is.
Well, Roger, we appreciate that, and we appreciate you coming in, and thank you very much indeed for spending some time with
Pleasure,
us.
Pleasure, mate.
So as Roger was coming in and getting his camera, obviously everything stops for Mr. Daltrey.
Uh-huh.
Thanks a lot, Mr. Daltrey. I had just started reading an email from Griffin Hansen, and I don't want to annoy Griffin.
Well, no, I mean, Griffin took the time to email in, so really.
So, Griffin, this is the completion of the your email. Simon and Matt, about Joe's lovely email, this is on our last... Oh, we've got Roger coming back in again. There we go.
One bag somewhere.
There you go.
Goodness me, that was close.
We've gone through it. We've gone through it.
Don't look us in, Roger. Lovely.
I don't know. You recorded one interview with Roger Daltrey, then you can't get rid of him.
No. Left his bag in.
Have a word with security. Chuck him out.
Oh, dear, oh, dear.
Anyway, Griffin Hansen's not going to get his email read out. Joe's lovely email about crying through that scene on the beach in Deathly Hallows. I can report I had exactly the same experience with my mum. She read me all the Potter books as they came out, starting when I was three. The spiders in book two were traumatic, but I wouldn't let her quit. By the time Deathly Hallows came out, I was 10 and well able to read them by myself. Still, we kept the tradition, and she read the 7th book aloud in a 3-day, 8 hours of reading a day marathon. When we got to that scene, she started crying so hard, I yelled at her and snatched the book away to keep going myself. To this day, despite many, many listens to the audiobooks, this remains the only part of the quasi-sacred text that I've read to myself, and all because my mum couldn't get the words out clearly enough. Glad to know I wasn't the only kid impatient with adult blubbering. From Griffin, and Griffin signs it, female and a Ravenclaw, go figure.
Yeah, I can understand that, actually. The idea that your parent is crying so much and you're like, why are you crying? Tell me the story. The purpose of you being here is to tell me the story. I don't need you to react to the story. I just want to hear, that's why we're doing this. You're reading it to me. So I'm
Mum.
Very much in Griffin's corner. Paul Eldham says, thanks to Books of the Year for introducing me to The Economist, which thankfully is available to download from HLH Social Library Service, as I really can't afford the Dead Tree version. Well, the good news is that if you follow the code that we've given you, you get a free print copy of The Economist. Is that
office
still going?
Active?
They still there with us? Excellent. Good to know.
Check previous shows for details.
Obs.
And Rupert Denham Hall, can anyone recommend any awesome non-fiction books? I'm currently in the final stages of reading The World As It Is by Ben Rhodes, and he was a previous guy on the show. So non-fiction book, I would go with Sapiens, I would think.
Oh, that is such a good book.
Yuval Harari. Yeah, so I would go with that, and other people will get in touch. Can we encourage you, please, to get in touch? It would be very nice to hear from you. Anything you want to tell us, that's booksoftheyear@yahoo.com, and you can tweet us at booksoftheyear.
Yes.
And thanks for all the limericks which are coming in, and they will be discussed, and we will hand out our gift voucher.
Yes, my mum is very happy that she's apparently been trending on Twitter, which is going to make Christmas that little bit easier.
Yes,
I hope.
So we'll give away our WH Smith voucher.
Yes,
on next week's program.
And
when
I say
next week's program, what I mean is whenever it comes.
Whenever this comes out, I do hope as well that people have been using the mayo button in the WH Smiths on
mayo.
Their tails. Mayo, where's my extra 10% off Michael Parkinson's book? Excellent.
Yes. I think that's a very good thing. I must go and do that now before I forget. And then people just think, the guy's a lunatic. He's shouting
his own name.
Thank you very much indeed for downloading us. Tell all your friends, subscribe wherever you can subscribe for your podcast.
That was smooth.
I think so.
Well done.
Quite a fay with the whole thing. Robin Ince is going to be our next guest because he's desperate and he wants to.
No! Written a very good book, that's why he's on.
Oh, that's why. That's absolutely why. And he was on the Daily Politics.
The Daily Politics?
Or whatever it is. The Andrew Neil.
Oh, yes.
Thing that he does with Michael Portillo.
Okay.
That one.
That one. He was on that, wasn't he?
He was on that.
So good.
He's a little bit desperate.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, hi, Robin.